Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today I'm thrilled to have Mike O'Brien on the show again. Mike is Professor of History and Legal Studies at Bryant University in Rhode Island, and last time he was here, we talked about his book on the trial of perpetrators working in the Operation Reinhardt camps. His new book project is something different, a textbook called A World History of War Crimes, published by Bloomsbury Press. In a brief 240 pages, it moves from the ancient Near East to American responses to 9/11. It's packed with detail, and interested readers will learn a lot about the contents of treaties and agreements and ideas. But I have to say, it's the interpretive framework of the book that I find most interesting. So we'll spend the next 45 minutes or an hour and try and touch on both parts of the book as we talk to Mike about the evolution of ideas of war crimes and attempts by people and societies to put a limit on the extent to which what kinds of violence are accepted and tolerated and viewed as ethical. And so we'll do that for the next hour. So Mike, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us again on New Books in Genocide Studies.
Thanks, Kelly. It's great to be back.
So usually I start by asking guests to say something about themselves, but we've already done that the last time. So I'd like to frame that question a bit differently. You're trained as a lawyer and as a historian. And so I'm wondering if you could say something about how your legal training impacts what you do as a historian.
Oh, goodness. That's a $64,000 question. That you
yeah, in 2 minutes or less with no ums or pauses.
Yeah, that's a difficult question to ask, although it's one that I should be prepared, of course, to answer, because it does come up from time to time. I'm actually of the view that the methods of the lawyer or the jurist on the one hand and the historian on the other are similar in the sense that we're both concerned with evidence. This is what sets history apart from novel writing, for example, or poetry, is that we... Although we might be interested in a rhetorical flourish from time to time, we're still very much attached to the factual record. We need to make cases, just like lawyers who are representing clients have to make a case backed by evidence. And they might interpret it in a way that's favorable to their position. But nonetheless, in both cases, whether it's a lawyer or an historian, we are moored to evidence. And so I think there's a natural affinity between law and history. I don't think that it's an accident that the most popular degree, and this has been the case for 50 or 60 years, the most popular degree for people who go to law school is history, because the methods, I think, are consonant with each other. In my own case, I think that my legal background led me in the direction of this current book project, interestingly enough, and it actually goes back to lectures that I did when I was an Air Force captain, a JAG, working in Germany. I did lectures for troops who were being deployed in support of Operation Desert Storm, which was the war in Iraq in 1991. And I had to provide them with a briefing on the law of armed conflict, specifically the Geneva Conventions and Hague Conventions. And I was really struck every so often I would get get questions from some of the younger troops in particular, who were astonished that there were any limitations to what they could do in battle. And so the concept of a Geneva Convention or Hague Convention was very, very foreign to them, and they bristled at the idea that they could be restricted in the amount of violence they could inflict upon the enemy. And I was very struck by that at the time, and I think to a certain extent that experience planted a seed in my head that I returned to 15 to 20 years later in planning this World History of War Crimes as a textbook that would reach hopefully a fairly broad audience. This is my hope, my intention, to acquaint readers with the fact that throughout world history, war has never or rarely been a free-for-all. It has usually been embedded within a larger framework that has tended to impose constraints upon what armies could do to their enemies, to other soldiers, as well as to civilians in combat. So that I think that's a very pragmatic, a very direct and concrete connection between my former career as a lawyer and this project that I've most recently been working on.
You mentioned that this is intended to be a textbook. So how is writing a textbook different from writing a monograph that's aimed more topically or aimed at a different audience? How did you approach the process, or did you approach this process differently?
I certainly did. For one thing, for me at any rate, I can't speak in terms of other people's experiences who've tried to tackle textbooks. I found it a lot easier. When you're writing a monograph, you have to just amass enormous amounts of primary source documentation, which typically involves, for those of us who do European or foreign work, we have to go to archives overseas. It can be very expensive and time-consuming, and it involves an enormous expenditure of labor and focus and attention. In terms of making that transition from writing monographs to textbooks, I find the textbook to be a simpler chore, a simpler task. For me, it just involved amassing a lot of secondary source information, some primary source material as well, but things I could typically locate through, if not through my library, then through interlibrary loan. And so I actually had just stacks and stacks of books arranged on my couch. I used the old Raul Hilberg method, like Raul Hilberg said that he used a card table in which to arrange his materials chronologically and topically. And so following Raul's technique, I used our couch. And so I had the ancient material on the furthermost left part of the couch on that end, and then moved progressively towards the modern era. The further right that you moved on the couch, then the closer you got to the present time. And I found this to be much, much easier. In fact, I was able to write the textbook within just a few months. It took me, I think, heavy-duty writing. I did the rough draft. It was about 155,000 words by the time I was done. I did it in the summer, so June, July, August. I was able to knock it out for the most part. And, of course, I polished it and did some editing in the months ensuing after the completion of the draft. But I was surprised how quickly it went. Once I had some idea of what I wanted to do, and I was able to set this thing up both spatially, on my couch in my study, so I could see it, and it would just seeing the physical books kind of imprinted on me, some sense of the flow for the books, so that when I began writing, it just it went almost effortlessly. It was far easier for me than the monographs, the two monographs I've written prior to the textbook. But of course, what you're doing with the textbook is you're largely summarizing the work of many other people. You're trying to convey to your readers a sense of the landscape of the field. And so, for me, it involved summarizing the work of a wide range of scholars, not just lawyers, jurists, but also archaeologists and specialists in violent studies and criminologists. Anthropologists, cultural anthropologists, physical anthropologists, and then trying to digest some of the the more important works that have been produced on the topic of war and war crimes and history, and then communicate that to the audience as forcefully and directly as I can.
So I want to ask you about a couple of the words in the title. And the first one is the obvious one. Is it possible to say what a war crime is?
It is. But of course, when you're trying to write a world history of war crimes, then you get all kinds of definitional issues.
Yeah.
Because the concept, of course, didn't really exist until much, much later. And I tried to make that clear in the textbook, mm-hmm. The concept of war crime. And in fact, the concept of a crime is itself, at least in our sense of the term, is relatively recent. It grows out of, in the West at least, it grows out of Roman canon law. And the concept of certain offenses against God and against the church, which were difficult to expunge through the penitential cell, through doing penance. And so this idea of grave offenses that were particularly jarring and particular to both to the community and to the Almighty grew into a concept of crime, and it originates in a sense of very serious sins. So even at that point, the notion of a crime in our sense was at the very best, it was inchoate. It was newly formed. It had not really assumed the kinds of proportions that it would later take in the history of law. And certainly when you go back and look at ancient cultures, whether it's ancient Sumeria, the Mesopotamian cultures of ancient Babylon, if you look at the Persians or the Greeks or the Romans, even their conceptions of crime were very, very different from ours. They did not distinguish between two areas of the law that we distinguish between, which are private acts like torts, and civil wrongs, personal injuries, which are typically dealt with through compensation, through lawsuits and compensation, and offenses in which the community recognizes the gravity of the offense as being directed against society, so that the government, as a representative of society, presumes to exercise jurisdiction over that offense, and instead of the payment of damages, you have some form of a punishment. The payment of a very, very steep fine, but more usually something more painful. For us, it's incarceration, and in the old days, it would involve more corporal forms of punishment, which could be quite grisly, as you know. But that distinction grows up much, much later in early modernity and didn't really exist as such in the ancient cultures that I explore in the first several chapters of the textbook. So yeah, it's a difficult concept, but the fact that you can't really speak of war crimes in our sense of the term in history does not mean that there were not normative constraints imposed on war. And that was the thrust of my approach to this project. I wanted to see how it was that societies tried to limit the carnage of battle. And to a certain extent, the voice of that young soldier back in 1992 who was expressing astonishment that there were actual restrictions in what he could do to the enemy in combat, I think that voice was still chirping in my mind as I approached this project.
Yeah, and that one theme comes through really strongly in the book. And what while you don't spend a lot of time on the ancient Near East, and I guess Mediterranean world, I found that section particularly interesting. Could you talk a little bit about where the limitations on violence, where people in that period understood the limitations on violence to come from, and to what degree those limitations actually worked?
As I discovered, delving into the secondary literature on the ancient world, the specific focus on warfare, what became clear is that in one culture after another, constraints on war arose from religion. And the further back we go, the closer and closer, and the more direct, the more proximate this connection between religion and warfare was. And so whether it's Shang China or ancient Sumer, you find at the very origins of of human communities and, of course, eventually city-states, the rise of urban environments, you will find that religion is driving so many of the restrictions that a culture imposes on the waging of war. So the short answer to your question is that religion is the cradle, insofar as we can tell, of these limitations on war. Now, that doesn't mean that a humanitarian religious perspective informs these restrictions. I don't think that was the case at all. And in fact, I try to demonstrate in the book that humanitarianism arises much, much later in the history of civilization as a driving force behind restricting war. Early on, religion was primarily ceremonial. It was designed to try to align the physical and social world with the supernatural world, with the cosmos in particular. And so this required intensive attention through the priesthood in particular to regulating society in such a way as to bring it into alignment with the cosmic order, with the supernatural world. So all actions had to coincide with that higher reality as the culture understood or interpreted that reality. And this applied to all areas of the culture, including, of course, warfare, so that war had to be fought in a certain manner consistent with the religious worldview of the culture. And that is true of China. It's true of ancient India. It's really true of every society in the ancient world, that I looked at. I did not have a chance to because of page limitations, I wasn't able to look at the Mesoamerican realm, the Aztecs, the Mayans, the Toltecs, and so forth. But again, that would be another area that is applicable as well. And you also find a kind of a law of war arising in Mesoamerica as well. In the ancient world, this seems to be almost a universal feature of these cultures, is the embedding of normative constraints on warfare within a larger religious framework.
And you address, you talk about that in that chapter, you talk about it with Rome. And one of the kind of interesting consistencies there is a sense in which the limitations on violence that you apply to people in your own community or in at least your own family of communities are different than those people who are outside of their communities. And I was really struck by that. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
It's one of the more important themes of the book. There are several themes that I think are prominent, and that's certainly one of them. Again, if we look at the history of warfare and the law of war comparatively, what we see, again, this is transcultural in one civilization after another, is a tendency to release constraints in conflict with cultural outsiders. And so, you know, the Greeks, of course, distinguished between themselves, you know, cultural Greeks, members of the Greek city-states, and the barbarians, individuals who emanated from an entirely different linguistic and cultural tradition than the Greeks. And not surprisingly, they tended to disregard their law of war, their constraints on warfare when they were going to war against the barbarians. Certainly true for the Romans as well. The Romans who were certainly not patsies when it came to fighting against anybody. They were extremely ferocious in their warfare. We still use this term a Roman war. A Roman war today means a war that's just almost without inhibition. It's still a phrase that is retained in our lexicon. It goes back to ancient Rome. They were extremely violent in their warfare. But if you look at their military conflicts, the Roman wars that were the most ferocious and fearsome were wars fought against non-Latin people, so people outside of the Mediterranean basin. And the further the Romans went in their conquests outside of the Mediterranean, the more brutal and the more savage their style of warfare tended to be, again, because they're distinguishing between Latinate peoples with whom they had something in common culturally and those who were outsiders. And again, this reproduces itself also in the church's attitudes during the Crusades, in which crusading armies fought so-called mortal wars, guerre mortelle was the phrase that was used. These are mortal wars in which the law of war was simply jettisoned in dealing with the Muslims or dealing with heretics like the Albigensians, really dealing with anybody who was outside that that European Christian cultural sphere. They were liable to being dealt with remorselessly, without any restriction, without any normative constraint to temper and mitigate the violence. And so we see this, you know, even in the modern era. It comes down even into our own time, in which individuals who are deemed to be outside outside the boundaries of protection afforded by the culture's legal system are dealt with severely. So this is one of the accelerants I try to argue in the book to the commission of war crimes, you know, waging war against the outsider. This is the ideology which the European colonists brought with them to the New World and which they applied in their dealings with the Aztecs and with the native peoples in South America, and certainly the North American colonists too in their dealings with native peoples, beginning with the colonization of New England, and of course in Virginia as well, dealing with native peoples there. We see that willingness to disregard limitations and to practice extreme forms of violence against the cultural outsiders.
And that's also true, and you actually don't, probably for word limits, don't spend a lot of time on Islamic cultures, but you do comment on Islamic attitudes toward violence and warfare in the early part of Islamic history. And they have a similar kind of, I don't know if division is the right word, but distinction between insiders and outsiders.
Very much, yeah. This concept of the peoples of the book. We know from the historical record that Islamic culture, especially in the 7th and 8th centuries, in the years after the 7th and 8th centuries too, but especially during that pivotal kind of formative time of Islam, Islamic cultures tended to moderate their policies of warfare when it involved individuals who were, again, considered to be more culturally connected to Islam, the peoples of the book, who were people of Jewish descent and Christians, individuals who shared a common text with the Muslims, were typically dealt with far more mildly in warfare than again, a cultural outsiders, individuals who did not share that overlap with Islamic culture. And that distinction arose fairly early in the history of the Islamic law of war.
Yeah, and we're taping this interview in March of 2017, and you cannot get away from kind of cultural assumptions or ideas about or histories of Islam in the modern world. So what can you tell us about attitudes toward violence in that early, kind of early, as in the formative period of Islamic culture?
Islamic culture, of course, arose much later historically than either Christianity or Islam. And it arose at a time when there were already pre-existing religious groups on the Arabian Peninsula against whom early Muslims engaged in military conflict. And these individuals were regarded by early Muslims as being active opponents, as being oppositional figures to the truth of Islam. And they were dealt with fairly severely, again, because they were outsiders. And yet, we see already at the origins of Islam a tendency to extend a certain degree of protection through their law of war, which was connected with the Quran and with the teachings of Muhammad, to extend certain protections to prisoners of war in particular. And this would eventually become an area of contestation within Islam, but it's fairly clear from early on that the major jurists within the Islamic cultural sphere believed that one's duty when a war captive fell under your control was to care for that individual and to ensure their safety, which may come as a surprise, I don't know, but may come as a surprise to some individuals today who, you know, based upon 9/11 and ongoing acts of terrorism by extremists, might think of Islam as just being inherently violent in its style of warfare. But again, the historical record is a corrective to that impression. And in fact, Islamic culture extended very, very pronounced protections to war captives, to POWs, and I think far more so certainly than either the Greeks or the Romans did. Huh. The Greco-Roman tradition was that everything within battle is a spoil of the victor. So that if a city is laid under siege and resists the siege, then everybody, all of the combatants, the male combatants and non-combatants, can be killed, and then the women can be enslaved along with the children. And we don't find the same level of disregard for the safety and well-being of prisoners of war in the early phases of Islamic culture, as it's still kind of trying to find itself as a religious faith and as a cultural form.
One of the other places where this distinction between, you know, insiders and outsiders, or us and them, or whatever it is, shows up in this sentence is in the codes of chivalry that emerge in medieval Europe. So to what extent are these codes of chivalry, do they function, or do they see themselves as legal or customary limits on the use of violence?
Chivalry was never intended to be a universal normative legal system. Chivalry was actually intended to govern the behavior of the milites, or the knights. Of course, they were called milites, which is the basis to our term military. But the knights were in most cases noblemen or people of noble extraction who fought on behalf of a sovereign. And over time, a code arises, which we identify with chivalry, which was supposed to govern the relations in battle between noblemen, between the milites and their battles against each other. Now, over the course of time, courts of chivalry do arise, especially in England and in France. You have courts of chivalry in which offenses against the chivalric order are actually tried. But make no mistake about it, there was no expectation that chivalry would extend beyond the relations of these Christian noblemen, knights, with each other in their battles. And for that reason, then, a nobleman was not in any way restricted in his dealings with the commoners, you know, with the foot soldiers who hailed from peasant backgrounds, for example. Chivalry did not apply to them, and we have from the historical records, it's very clear we have evidence of what we today would call war crimes committed with impunity by noblemen upon commoners, and they were not held accountable for this either legally or normatively, because they were dealing with their social inferiors. There was an attitude on the part of the aristocrats, upon the knights and their commanders, that a commoner who raises his weapons against a knight in any event is usurping his proper function within feudal society. And the feudal society, his proper function in feudal society is to be servile, is to recognize his place, and not to use devices like the crossbow, for example, or the ballista, some of these early or the early weapons of mass destruction. That's interesting to hear. That's more or less how they were referred to at the time. The mass destruction, they were considered extremely violent. Why? Because a commoner, a foot soldier, could use a crossbow to shoot a knight off of a horse and kill him without actually engaging him in battle. Of course, the peasant oftentimes did not have adequate training in combat, did not even have adequate arms in most cases. So it was always at a perpetual disadvantage in dealing with a knight. But once the crossbow was developed, then the commoner was able to level the playing field and could actually kill the knight. That advantage the knights had possessed was offset. And so we see efforts, believe it or not, to make it illegal for people to use the crossbow, supposedly because it was too violent. The real reason is because it enabled the commoners to fight back effectively against the knights, against the aristocrats. But we see really horrific war crimes committed by knights on commoners in combat. I won't get into the details, but I talk about some of the cases in the book. But they're every bit as horrific as war crimes committed during World War II, or even today in Syria. They're every bit as bad and as violent and as homicidal. But it was not considered a violation of chivalry because they were committed against commoners. So there were limitations, very, very real limitations on chivalry. It was not a universal code of law or even of ethics.
So this is maybe an interesting time to pull back a little bit, because one of the things in your book, one of the themes that emerges is this distinction between a theoretical, maybe even a philosophical discussion about limitations and violence and the kind of customs of practice that emerge. So looking before the 1800s, to what degree are there connections between people who are writing about this and people who are actually doing the fighting?
What's really striking, or at least was striking for me as I prepared the book, was the relative disconnection between the theory of constraint, the theory of the law of war, and the actual practice of the law of war. And you find theoreticians going back into the ancient world, people like Cicero, for example, the Stoics, who were very influential in Cicero and actually gave rise to some fairly sophisticated thinking about natural law and the idea of a universal sense of justice, which ought to prevail in people's relations with each other, not just between people within the same society, but between societies that are involved in military conflict. But of course, the Romans paid very little attention to that. Cicero could write his books, that's all well and good, but the Roman legion would do pretty much what it wanted to do. There was no overarching authority that would impose Ciceronian ideas of restraint and decency on the Roman legions and their dealings with the Carthaginians, or with their dealings with any of the people of other countries, of other cultures whom they subdued and subjugated. And that's true, moving forward as well.
So, and I know we're skipping over lots of material here in the interest of time, and so I'd encourage people who are listening, there's lots of good stuff in this first half of the book that we're touching on and then moving past. But it seems to me that you describe something of a watershed change that happens in the 19th century. And one of the changes, I guess, or at least that I see you talking about, is the distinction between treaties that are bilateral treaties and treaties that emerge out of a process of multilateral negotiation. So first of all, I guess, am I reading that right? And if I am, why is there this sudden move that we see reflected in the Geneva and the Hague agreements to a broader, more multinational approach?
Well, one of the chief limitations, of course, of a bilateral treaty, which were the typical treaties, really, up until the late 19th and early 20th century. But most treaties were bilateral. That is, and again, for those who maybe are new to these legal concepts, bilateral is a treaty involving two parties. The most conspicuous limitation is that whatever is agreed upon is restricted entirely to the two parties involved to that treaty. It obviously would have no binding influence upon other non-parties to the agreement. Whereas a multilateral treaty, which sometimes would begin as a bilateral agreement, but might actually attract signatories from other countries as well. The advantage of a multilateral treaty is that it applies to more countries. And the more countries that are involved, then the more under international law each individual country must seek to comply with the terms of that treaty. why it is that we see a movement in the direction of multilateral treaties by the late 19th century, I think, has a lot to do with the increasing destructiveness of warfare. And I try to a certain extent, to at least touch on that history in my textbook. Again, I had page limitations, word limitations. I was not able to get into the kind of detail that maybe I would have liked to, or that other scholars might want. But I do touch upon the highly destructive nature of warfare, which is tied in with technology, with the development of rifling and ballistics, the development of long-range ballistic technology, such as machine guns by the end of the 19th century, which really just revolutionized the destructiveness of warfare. Not to mention the rise of national armies, the so-called nation in arms idea, which begins really with the French Revolution and then becomes widely imitated in the century after the outbreak of the French Revolution. So the idea of the levée en masse, where people rally around the nation state to defend it. So you have enormous citizen armies, which by the 19th century then are equipped with highly destructive technological capability, so that the ability to harm the enemy grows substantially. So we move from the era of the pitched battle in the 18th century to highly destructive, you know, conflicts by the 19th. And so in the Crimean War, in the U.S. Civil War, in the Franco-Prussian War, the rates of lethality just really skyrocket. And it's not surprising then that we see international jurists and politicians beginning to talk about the need for multilateral treaties, not just bilateral treaties that can involve combatants who are directly engaged with each other, but actual multilateral treaties that can stem this tide of hyper-destructiveness and reduce the carnage, especially the unnecessary carnage of warfare.
So if people have heard, non-specialists anyway, have heard anything about conventions about violence, they've heard about the Geneva and the Hague agreements. So maybe you could say a little bit about what kinds of violence the Geneva and Hague agreements tried to limit, and what kinds of, I don't know, people or organizations were subject to those limits.
Geneva was chiefly driven by the desire to reduce the suffering of soldiers, of combatants in warfare. Of course, the most immediate impulse to Geneva was the Crimean War, and it goes back, of course, to Henri Dunant and his book on his experiences at the Battle of Solferino, in which he saw thousands and thousands of wounded individuals just lying on the battlefield and without access to medical care, without access to any ameliorative, you know, any kind of medication that could assuage their suffering, and people crying out in pain, perishing on the battlefield in agony. And Dunant was extremely moved by this, and he becomes the driving force then behind what eventually will become, of course, the creation of the International Red Cross. Mm-hmm. And the first of a series of Geneva Conventions, the first being in 1864. But the focus of Geneva was on the suffering of soldiers, and it tried to provide a multilateral basis upon which countries would agree that in warfare they would extend medical care and the opportunity for medical care in particular to other soldiers on the enemy side. What became clear by the end of the 19th century was that Geneva and also some other conventions, like the Brussels Declaration and the Oxford Manual and some others, were not attentive enough to other protected persons or persons who should enjoy protection under the laws of war, especially civilians. And so there was some effort to rectify this by the late 19th century through the first Hague Conference in 1899. A second one then is convened in 1907. And it's here where we see, for the first time, an effort to develop an international treaty, a binding international treaty, that would elicit concern and protection for civilians in wartime. And as it turns out, even the Hague Convention was not adequate to the task of really fully protecting civilians and noncombatants. And so we see then later on by 1929, there's another effort to reform the Geneva Conventions. That effort dies a mourning, unfortunately, chiefly because of the rise of fascism. Mm-hmm. Hitler's coming to power in 1933, and the telescoping then down towards the Second World War, which broke out in 1939. So this effort to change Geneva is aborted until after the war, and of course we see then after 1945 efforts to really overhaul the Geneva Conventions and make them more attuned to the suffering and the lives and well-being of civilians caught up in warfare. And of course, this also involves important distinctions between international conflicts and insurgencies that grow up within a nation state that maybe are not international, but it might be desirable to extend the protections of international law to people involved in them. So we see by 1949, there are four Geneva Conventions that are passed. And common to each of them is Article 3, which tries to extend the protections of Geneva to conflicts not of an international character, is the phrase that is used. So presumably that would apply to situations of involving civil wars, involving insurgencies of groups against the government. And common Article 3 today is probably the most important single protection afforded to domestic insurgencies and to internal discords within countries.
And yet, if I remember the book right, there's significant argument about that, right? That there's certainly figures at these conventions and military figures outside of them who are arguing against the limitations on violence, presumably because that would impact their ability to achieve their objectives.
Exactly right. Yeah, it's the age-old problem of military necessity, which again is not a new, as I discovered in my research for the book, is not a new phenomenon. I mean, you find Indian commentators a couple thousand years ago talking about this as well. Like one named Kautilya, who was such a real politiker, such an advocate of pragmatism, and of really expedience in the waging of war, that he violates the most fundamental tenet of the law of war that we find everywhere in civilization, which is the prohibition of poison. Right? Something you find in virtually every culture condemns the deployment of poison as a weapon against the enemy. Well, not Kautilya. Kautilya, Indian commentator on the Indian law of war, who believed that under certain circumstances it was perfectly fine to use poison if it enabled you to win. This is the essence of military necessity. And the human race, and I say human race because I think this is transcultural, has struggled with the concept of military necessity for several thousand years, and we see it even today. Because if you have a situation in which some enormous good is hanging in the balance, if you can achieve victory by committing a crime, the temptation is going to be to commit the crime if that is what is deemed necessary to achieve the overriding good that you're seeking. And not surprisingly, we see departures from the law of war in situations in which policymakers, you know, whether they're government officials, whether they're military commanders, think they can achieve a victory. They can have a breakthrough triumph by simply disregarding the law of war and committing war crimes, at least acts that would be considered to be violations of the law of war, to be grave breaches in the language of the Geneva Conventions, and therefore illegal under international law. But we see over and over again, whether it's in the Algerian conflict in the 1950s, mm-hmm. Whether it's in the Vietnam War, the United States' involvement in Vietnam in the 1960s, and most recently, of course, what the Bush administration had called the global war on terror, beginning with 9/11 and then the invasion of Iraq, we see this tendency to elevate military necessity and expedience above international law.
So surely people at these conferences in the 19th century understood this. So how did they envision the agreements that they oversaw and signed being enforced?
Yeah, well, that's an exceedingly important but very, very complicated question. Of course, that this is the problem that has bedeviled international law forever. And it's for this reason that many people, including even today, the skeptics will say that there's no such thing as international law. Mm-hmm. And you will still find law professors in American law schools who will declare ex cathedra. They'll simply declare that there's no such thing as international law. Why? Because it's not really enforceable. Uh-huh. Well, in point of fact, it is kind of enforceable, even though it has been not as widely enforced, say, as domestic law would be. There have been efforts to enforce its terms. We do have today various judicial bodies that try to enforce the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Conventions and the Genocide Convention as well. You look at certainly the ad hoc tribunals for Yugoslavia, formed in the 1990s, dealing with the crimes committed during the Balkan Wars. And, of course, Rwanda, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. There's another UN tribunal that is formed in Cambodia to try to tackle the crimes of the Khmer Rouge in the 1970s. There are bodies that have been constituted, as well as the International Criminal Court, which is the first true international court, permanent international court, devoted to protecting the interests of international humanitarian law, which came into being in 1998. So we do have judicial bodies that seek to enforce these principles. But, of course, enforcement is only as effective as the nation states, especially the superpowers of the world, are willing to allow it to be. Mm-hmm. And we know that the United States has certainly done everything it can to exempt the United States and its citizens from ever being prosecuted, say, in the International Criminal Court.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you, does responsibility to protect and the ICC, is this a conceptually new idea, or is this just kind of an intensification of an older understanding of limits on violence and human rights?
Well, I try to suggest in my textbook that these concerns have been around a long, long time. Again, going back to the ancient world, documents like the Mahabharata or the Rig Veda, some of these ancient Indian texts, the Manusmriti, called the Book of Manu. There are numerous Indian texts. You find comparable customs reduced to, in some cases, reduced to writing in the Koine Nomina of the Greeks. All of these express, to a certain extent, a concern for the suffering of civilians. But, of course, those concerns were always counterbalanced by exceptions, and mm-hmm. that was true really up until 1945. Consider, for example, the time-hallowed idea that non-combatants should not be deliberately harmed. You should not be, in other words, killed by soldiers and during combat. Well, there are numerous exceptions to that, and one of the exceptions was the concept of hostage taking and collective responsibility. Mm-hmm. Now, if a military unit, if an army moves into an area that it's conquered and creates an occupying force within that territory, under the traditional law of war, that army was able, if it wished to take hostages from the population. It could arrest civilians who had nothing to do with the war and essentially hold them as sureties to guarantee against attacks launched against the occupying forces. And if there was an attack made upon the occupiers, the occupied government, the military government there, would be justified in killing those civilians as a form of reprisal. And this comes up actually after World War II in the context of a case tried at Nuremberg as one of the successor trials. U.S. versus von Lieb. Actually, there were a couple of them, von Lieb and von List, but they involved generals who were active in the Balkans during the German occupation of Yugoslavia. who were charged with killing civilians, and their defense was that they had taken these civilians as hostages. And so that when partisan bands in Yugoslavia attacked the German army, the Germans asserted their right under the traditional law of war to execute hostages in reprisal. And that principle, by the way, was even recognized by the U.S. court that presided over the Germans' case.
Huh.
Now, the Germans didn't get away with it, as it turns out, because their response was considered to be disproportionate. They had executed too many civilians and not an appropriate number that was proportionate to the attacks on the German army. And so they were held to be guilty and to be responsible for those attacks on civilians. But the principle of hostage taking was actually upheld. It was the most controversial verdict passed by an American court at Nuremberg. But as you can see, though, these principles hollowed out to a certain extent some of the protections against civilians. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was. There's a longstanding understanding or principle that you should not wantonly attack civilians, but you could take some as hostages and hold them collectively responsible for attacks upon your forces. Now, of course, in 1949, the Geneva Conventions are passed, and they explicitly prohibit any such hostage taking, any such collective reprisal against civilians, which is a major movement forward in the history of international humanitarian law. That was not always the case.
So you mentioned these trials. So given the interest of people who are probably listening to this podcast, can I ask you to spend just a little bit of time talking about the effort to try some of the planners and perpetrators with Armenia, and whether that effort fits into the broader kind of halting efforts to hold Germans accountable for war crimes, or whether that's something conceptually different.
This history is exceedingly unfortunate from one angle, because of course Allied trials of Turkish perpetrators never took place. Despite a provision of the original treaty, Treaty of Sèvres, which was eventually replaced by the Treaty of Lausanne, but the original Sèvres Treaty provided specifically for trials of Turkish perpetrators involved in the Armenian genocide. And we know that chiefly because of political considerations, a decision is made to exclude that language from the successor treaty that would govern relations with the Turks, and that language about a trial of Turkish perpetrators was excised, and the entire effort collapsed. Yeah. So that so many of the perpetrators were not held accountable in an international court, although originally there was an intention to move forward with that. What's interesting is that this history, this abortive history in the Allied intention to prosecute Turks for genocide, then comes back in 1945 and 1946, and we see Allied policymakers making reference to the failures to deal with Turkish perpetrators after World War I as a justification now for prosecuting Nazi war criminals as well as Japanese war criminals in the Pacific. The idea was to try to avoid the debacle of impunity enjoyed by Turkish perpetrators after World War I. And by the way, you probably know this already, but maybe some of your listeners aren't aware. Many of the top-ranking perpetrators of the violence were in fact assassinated by Armenian assassins in the 1920s. Just going to show that if a court does not exist that can prosecute these awful crimes and provide some sense of justice to people in society, then people will seek redress in other ways. They will take the law into their own hands, and they will return to a form of law which was called the blood feud. This is the Hatfield and the McCoys, right? People helping themselves to private justice, and this is what happens in the 1920s. So four or five of the top Young Turk leaders are gunned down, killed by Armenian assassins.
Yeah, it's so, and there's a good discussion of these trials, actually. I think his name is Gary Bass. I think the book is Stay the Hand of Justice or something like that.
The Hand of Vengeance, I think.
Vengeance, thank you.
Yeah.
One of the things that jumps out at me, you talk about this period as one where you have a new kind of, maybe, I don't know if it's a justification or an explanation or a basis, but there's a new kind of understanding about why war crimes are wrong. And you talked at the beginning of the interview about how the limits on violence in the ancient world were not based on humanitarian concerns, but all of a sudden humanitarian, that word has crept into our discussion. So how influential is this new idea that people should be, that limitations on violence should be derived from an inherent belief in the value of all people, regardless of their religious identity or national identity? How does that work?
Yeah, I think that this has become the reigning philosophy behind both international humanitarian law, which again is Geneva, and it's the Hague. That those two treaties and their principles are bundled together under this concept of international humanitarian law. When I use that phrase, that's what I'm talking about, Geneva and Hague. Humanitarianism now, I think, informs both of those conventions, but also, of course, human rights. And human rights is a much more recent sort of legal phenomenon, which now has converged with international humanitarian law in the sense that both of these legal regimes are concerned primarily to reduce suffering, especially unnecessary suffering, and to extend protections to certain groups of people who are not involved in military operations. This is the primary tenet of contemporary international criminal law, international human rights, and international humanitarian law. The idea, however, is very ancient, as you know. It goes back into the ancient world. I talk a little bit about this in the first chapter of my book, where I discuss the old concept of the Axial Age, an idea advanced by the German philosopher Karl Jaspers many years ago in a book, The Goal of History. It was called The Goal of History in English. But he advanced this idea that between 200 and 700, 800 BCE, you see this extraordinary flowering of ethical consciousness throughout the ancient world. And it's not just in one culture, it's in one culture after another, both in East and West. And the question is, how can we account for this remarkable flowering? We do see philosophers... And every so often, even a political ruler like Ashoka, the Buddhist ruler in India, who express a humanitarian concern for reducing the suffering of war. But again, as I suggest in the book, I don't see this humanitarian attitude taking root and affecting the conduct of armies, at least not right away. It takes, quite frankly, it takes a few... couple thousand years, really, until the 1800s and the 1900s, before these humanitarian insights, which I would suggest go back at least to the Axial Age of the first century BCE, before these ethical and religious and humanitarian insights begin to inspire people to use the law as a way to reduce the cruelty, the unnecessary suffering, and the savagery of warfare, and to do so explicitly for the purpose of reducing suffering.
So, I know, sadly, right now, the existence, the challenge that word limits can present you, as I'm in the process of cutting 25,000 words in the next 6 weeks. But so I know that there are limitations what you could do in the book. But I wonder, given without those limitations in this interview, are there strands of thinking about war crimes or about limitations on violence in the modern world that are outside of this tradition you've laid out that kind of mostly is a Western tradition? Are there ideas or arguments or perspectives on this from other parts of the world that we need to be aware of?
Again, this is a theme that I primarily announce in the first couple chapters of the book, where I do delve into developments in India and in China, especially in the ancient world, before kind of gradually moving in the direction of Greece and Rome. We spend some time talking about the Islamic world. again, because of page limitations and word limitations, I had to adopt a principle of organization in the book that really took the concept of continuity very seriously. It was one of the ways in which I was able to exclude some material that maybe I was tempted to put in and include other materials which were important. And the organizing principle was this. I was trying to come up with a narrative of sorts of how it is that we arrived at humanitarian law in by the late 19th century and certainly 20th century, now 21st century. How is it that we've arrived to where we are? And so, perforce, a great deal of the book is quite frankly focused on Western culture or cultures that are, you know, have been inspired by or culturally influenced by the West. Now, I try to counterbalance that to a certain extent by looking at traditions in India and traditions in China and references to Islamic culture. But for the most part, my narrative, it looks at Greece, at Rome, the Middle Ages, and its especially its development of the law of chivalry, and then eventually the age of exploration, in which Europe colonizes vast tracts of the Earth's surface. So I guess if a criticism could be made of the book, it might be that there is not enough attention paid to some of these alternative traditions, such as you were describing. I would have liked to have gotten into maybe more detailed consideration of modern day India. I think it was it Indira Gandhi who said that that so much of modern Indian law, especially in its approach to warfare, has been shaped by Ashoka, which is an extraordinary statement and one that would be worthy of exploring. So I guess if there was one limitation in the book, it's not quite as balanced in its in the net that it casts as maybe I would have liked it to be. But again, you have limited time, and it was important to talk about some of these developments growing out of World War I and especially World War II, which has been so formative. The Nuremberg jurisprudence, in particular, I just felt that instead of if I had talked at great length about the Mayans or the Aztecs, and I was at one point collecting materials on this theme, then I would have had to have omitted Nuremberg, or at least severely cut back Nuremberg. And as we know, Nuremberg is the cradle of modern-day international humanitarian law and human rights law. There's just no way in good conscience that I could do that. So perhaps in a subsequent edition of the book, I can address some of these other, I'm actually thinking about maybe approaching the publisher if they're so disposed. But that would require expanding the book. And it's, as you know, it's a matter of finances and markets. And if there was a market for it, I'm sure they would be, amenable to that idea. But that'll be the question. And so perhaps I'd have an opportunity to address some of these alternative conceptions that you're alluding to.
So Mike and I know each other for quite a while, and I can now see the look on his wife's face as she imagines her couch once again covered by textbook after textbook after textbook.
I need a dedicated couch. That's what I
There
need.
You go. Hey, we've taken a lot of your time. I always conclude by asking the same kind of questions at the end. And the first one, and I know you and I have talked about it a little bit, maybe you could suggest a book or two that people who listen to the podcast that have been important to you in shaping your thinking on these kind of issues that listeners might want to read.
Sure, there actually are several that I could mention. A couple of them are books that I cite in my textbook, A World History of War Crimes, and I found the books to be not only helpful in my own thinking about the law of war in history, but they're just fascinating books. They're great. Both of them are great reads, and I think one of them probably has reached a wider audience than the other. The one that I think is fairly well known, has reached a pretty broad audience, is John Keegan's A History of Warfare. Really, just Keegan is such a gifted prose stylist and writes with verve, and but also with great factual knowledge. He was a real expert in this area of study. And of course, he goes back, much as I try to do in the textbook, he goes back into the into the origins of civilization, back to the city states of Sumer, and traces the development forward. So I would highly recommend Keegan's book. It's very engaging. It's a great read, and not only enjoyable, but you can learn a great deal from him. I would also recommend another book that I drew upon in my own work. It's maybe requires more of an intellectual commitment in terms of just kind of working through it, because it's a very, very detailed book, I think a demanding book in a lot of ways. But for someone who hangs in there with it, it really pays dividends for your understanding of religion in particular. It's a book by the late Robert Bella called Religion and Human Evolution. A book that was really a cornerstone to the first chapter in particular of my study. And Bella, I think, was influenced by Jaspers' idea of the axial age, and that eventually becomes for me one of the frameworks in which I try to portray the early history in particular of the law of war that I deal with in the book. There are a couple of German books too. I suspect that you might have some German speakers.
Probably
out.
So.
One of the books has actually been translated into English. You can read it in German or in English. The German is it's by Sebastian Hafner. It's been out for quite a while. Hafner, H-A-F-F-N-E-R. A fairly well-known book. I think it came out in the 70s. Has gone through multiple editions. This is the kind of staying power that academics can only dream of. Right? you write a book 45 years ago, and it's still in print and still selling like gangbusters. And that's what Hafner's book has done. It's in German. It's called Anmerkungen zu Hitler. And it's been, I think, translated as The Meaning of Hitler in English. I've recommended this book to numerous people as I think the best introduction, the most concise statement of Hitler from a variety of perspectives, foreign policy, his ability to come to power, why it was that he was able to seize the imagination of so many people in Germany at the time, how he was able to preserve his power even as the war was slipping from his grasp in the 40s. How was he able to continue to command so much obedience from the German population? All of these topics and a lot more are addressed in about 178 pages in his book. So I recommend that one very, very highly. And then finally, I'll recommend another German book. Insofar as I know, this has not been translated into English. It's a book on the Kommissar Order. It's called Kommissar Befehl in German, by Felix Römer. I talk about the Kommissar Order in my World History of War Crimes, and some members of your listening audience may know about the Kommissar Order already. But that was the order issued to German troops before the invasion of the Soviet Union in June of 1941 to segregate from their Soviet prisoners of war those individuals who were Kommissars, that is, these ideological watchdogs who were assigned to Red Army units, and they were to be taken and separated from the other prisoners of war and essentially shot. And this gave rise to waves of war crimes, of mass executions of Soviet prisoners of war in the summer of 1941 and in the fall of 1941. So Römer does an excellent job providing the history of the Kommissar Befehl and traces out, empirically with voluminous amounts of evidence, his contention that most of the German units who received this Kommissar Befehl followed it to the letter. A lot of the generals after the war tried to distance themselves from it, claiming that they either disregarded the order or told their soldiers to stand down and not to enforce it. But rumors of the belief that that a great majority of them did in fact follow the order. And this is a really first-rate history. It does require a commitment, though. It's a big, tough German monograph. Of what I speak.
Yes, I do. Indeed.
But again, it's a superbly done monograph that I think would be of interest to anybody concerned with war crimes and history.
So the last question in just a few seconds, This is your third book. What might be your fourth?
Well, I'm in the midst of thinking that through right now, and there's a project that I'm trying to develop. To a certain extent, it's in response to the recent trial of John Demjanjuk, who's a Cleveland auto worker who was proven to be to have been a guard at Sobibor. You may recall back in the 80s there were allegations that he was a notorious war criminal named Ivan the Terrible, alleged to have worked at Treblinka and to have escaped Poland after the war. And he stood trial in Jerusalem at one point and was actually convicted and sentenced to death. And then the Israeli Supreme Court overturned his conviction. And they sent him back to the United States, at which point he had his citizenship restored. But then his citizenship was revoked yet again, a second time, when it was shown that he had, in fact, been a Nazi death camp guard, but he had been at Sobibor rather than Treblinka. So they sent him actually back to Munich to stand trial in a German court and charged with complicity to murder under German law. And he was convicted in 2011. His trial is quite significant in the history of German law because it represents a real watershed. You know, for the first time, German courts were willing to find a death camp guard guilty, even though there was no direct evidence of a specific criminal act that person had committed in the death camp. So all they had on Demjanjuk was evidence that he had served in the camp. In the years prior to 2011, that would have led to an acquittal for lack of a concrete criminal act that could be proven against the individual. Mere service prior to 2011, mere service in a death camp was not considered enough to sustain a case of homicide against a defendant. But in 2011, the Germans broke with their old practice and instead were willing to find Demjanjuk guilty. And they convicted him of homicide and of murder, actually, and sentenced him to jail. He died just a few months after his conviction. But I'm interested in how the Germans have arrived at a certain sympathy or a receptivity to this notion of collective responsibility within the context of death camp cases. So I'm interested in going back and exploring, you know, the roots of collective responsibility, again, looking at cultural history, cultural legal history in particular, looking at some of the post-war trials done by the Poles, who also develop a concept of collective responsibility for death camp guards at Auschwitz in particular. And, of course, the Americans as well in their military trials at Dachau develop similar ideas. So that more or less is the direction I'm headed in with what I hope to be my fourth book.
Well, when it's done, I hope you'll come back on the show. But I want to say thank you very much. And it's a great book, and I encourage people to read it. And until we talk to you again, thanks again.
Thank you.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Bryant about his new book, A World History of War Crimes. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. I hope you'll join us next time when I'll interview John Roth about his new book, edited work, Losing Trust in the World, Holocaust Scholars Confront Torture. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.